as based on what we heard, was consist of, let's say, a few people walking from Najaf to Karbala. But now, the same people, the same, actually, morale is now on the way, but with plenty of people from plenty of countries.
Yeah.
I think the number of countries exist in the world, we have representative in the Walk of Arba'in.
Yes.
And let's talk even some about the miracle of this event.
Great. Look, for gathering, a country, yeah. Inshallah, we'll talk about that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio. This is the last Savior, and we're talking about the relationship between Ashura and Mehtaviyat. Here we're talking about how Ashura will be recognized by all before the uprising of Imam Mahdi, ajallaha ta'ala faraj. Yes, Dr. Ali Alev.
Yeah, I was saying that...
The glory of
the glory
gathering.
Of this Arba'in actually astonishes not only the followers of other religions, but ourselves as the followers of the school of Ahlul Bayt.
True.
Look, who can believe that 30 plus million of people. Let's talk about 10 to 15 million people. Which country is able to feed these people for 10 consecutive days?
And a country that is devastated by wars.
Yeah, it was under lots of pressures, wars, and it's something that even when you enter this country, I mean, the cities of which is like, I mean, the villages of other countries.
Who are the victims of ISIS, who are the victims of American terrorism, and so on and so forth.
So this is a miracle that one can see. So you will not, stay thirsty or hungry for, let's say, a two-minute event.
Yeah.
So the whole way you are
being fed.
I mean, you are fed and you are offered different kinds of food so that you are welcome to the way that you have selected for visiting your imam.
Yes.
So this is one aspect of its miracle that it astonishes the whole mankind, not only the follower of the school of Arab. The next point that I wanted to refer to is that the same slogan that was talked about, that Ya Allah Tharat al-Hussein, which is the slogan and the flag, the sign of the flag of Imam Usman alayhi salam, Ya Allah Tharat al-Hussein, wants to emphasize that the revenge of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam will be taken from those that had caused this issue.
Yeah.
What happened to Imam al-Hussein?
Exactly. So, you're saying us that there will be a time where one of the connotations of this uprising is to take revenge.
And it is shown in the flag of it.
Yeah.
And then motto.
Yeah. But the criminals of the event of Ashura are not alive today. So how is it possible, like, with whom Imam is going to fight and take revenge from?
Very good question. Look, sister, even the issue, the event of Karbala itself, the event of Ashura is not known by the whole humanity.
Yeah.
Except the followers of the school of Ahlul Bayt, right? So how come that people will understand who was the, let's say, what were the factors and who were the people who were guilty in killing Imam Hussein so that a group of people come to take revenge from them? Okay, this is one aspect. As we answered that, okay, through the media of Arba'in, inshallah, it will be introduced, the concept itself will be introduced to the people.
This is
now,
one.
Yeah. Now, when the main factors, when the main, let's say, people who caused such a tragedy are not more available.
Yeah.
So whom are going to be to take a revenge from? The real factors and the real causes of this tragedy are nowhere available. So we said everyone knows that at that time the children of Bani Umayyah or Bani Umayyah destiny caused such a catastrophe on the day of Ashura. So, and again, we know that even at the time of the advent of Imam Usman alayhi salam, there would be the emergence of a person called Sufyani.
Sufyani, yeah, we have heard that.
Yeah. Sufyani is one of the signs of the appearance of Imam Usman alayhi salam. The emergence of Sufyani is one of the signs of the emergence of Imam Usman. So when Sufyani exists, I mean, or appears, which actually comes evident to us that Imam Usman is about to, inshallah, reappear.
Well, this all needs more explanation, like who is Sufyani and how Imam is going to take revenge and who are the criminals of the time from whom the revenge of Ashura will be taken. All this needs explanation, and we would want to continue that in another session, inshallah. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, sister.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, who are listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you want to listen to this program again, you can go to our official website, that's parstoday.com. Go to the tab Call of Islam and you'll find our old programs over there. In case you have any message for us, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until another session, fi amanillah and God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Midstream.
Eight Israeli F-16 fighter jets attacked both Aleppo Airport and Damascus Airport simultaneously in Syria last week. The world moved on. Syria didn't. Maybe if the news was Syrian fighter jets bombed Ben-Gurion Airport, the world would have stopped turning for a couple of days in complete awe of the horrific news. The attack of Wednesday night on Aleppo International Airport comes as an Israeli strike only months earlier took out the runway at the country's main airport in the capital, Damascus. The Israeli attack tore a hole in the runway and also damaged a nearby piece of tarmac and structure in the airfield, as shown here by satellite photos. A day after the attack, Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal al-Miqdad stated that Israel is playing with fire and exposing the security and military situation in the region to an explosion. Miqdad added that Syria will not remain silent in the face of the Israeli aggression and that Israelis will pay the price sooner or later. However, Israel is not to be blamed alone in its continuous attacks against Syria. The United States and its Western allies are all responsible for encouraging Israel to persist in aggression, threatening peace and security in West Asia. The latest round of Israeli violations against Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity was preceded by strikes of eight U.S. F-16 and F-15E fighter jets, which hit nine targets in Syria on August 25th. The same U.S. occupation that still maintains 19 terrorist training camps in Syria and has seized Syria's oil fields, costing Syria $100 billion so far in oil and gas sector losses. The U.S. Congress has never declared war nor authorized U.S. military force in Syria. Still, three successive presidents have ordered Syria bombed while giving a green light for Israel to keep attacking Syria. Before the 2011 U.S.-instigated war in Syria, the country was fully electrified with a national grid. Syria, a secular, multinational, multilingual country, had the highest educational level in the region and full, free healthcare. Now, millions of Syrians, more than 40% of the population, are displaced by the decades of U.S.-Israeli war. Add to that the illegal Caesar's Syria Civilian Protection Act of 2019, which further cuts all supplies for food, medicine, and reconstruction. After all this, it is only fair to see Syria retaliate to every strike it endures, whether by lighting up U.S. occupation bases east of the Euphrates, or maybe, just maybe, taking Ben-Gurion Airport out of service. Welcome to the Middle Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Israeli attack targeting a Syrian airport tore a hole in the runway and also damaged a nearby piece of tarmac and structure on the military side of the airfield in Aleppo International Airport. This is what satellite photos analyzed on Friday by the Associated Press showed us. Now, the attack of Wednesday night on Aleppo International Airport comes as an Israeli strike only months earlier took out the runway at the country's main airport in the capital, Damascus, over alleged Iranian weapons transfers to the country. Now, to discuss this very important issue with us from Atlanta, Georgia, is Mr. Aqil Hanano, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Aqil. Now, Israel bombs two of Syria's most important airports, international airports, one in Aleppo and the other one in Damascus, just days after the United States bombed Syria as well on August 25th in Deir ez-Zor. Now, there's no doubt that the U.S. and the Israelis coordinate their attacks against Syria, but what is it that's triggering this married old couple over aggressiveness and violence towards Syria? What are they really afraid of?
Well, to be honest with you, after 12 years of war on Syria and failure to impose their own will on the country, Syria now become like a punching bag for United States to affect the events in the Middle East and in the international arena in general. I don't think this is targeted just specifically to weaken Syria. Syria already gone through 12 years of war, and those continuous attack from the Israeli entity, it's only to further advance the goal of United States vis-a-vis Russia and Iran, because we all know there is Iranian advisors in Syria, and those came with the invitation of the Syrian government, but there is no military bases of Iranian in Syria. They are attacking Syrian posts. The murder are Syrian soldiers. There is no doubt in my mind this has nothing to do with Syria. It only has to do with the international event and the Middle East event.
Well, after the attack, we did hear Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal al-Miqdad saying that Israel is playing with fire and it's exposing the entire region and the world, its security and military situation to an explosion. Now, we also heard him saying that Syria will not remain silent in the face of the Israeli aggression, and he threatened that Israelis will be paying the price sooner or later because of this aggression against Syria that has been going on for 10 years now. But will Syria truly be able to deter Zionist aggression against its capital and other governorates in Syria? I mean, what tool is Syria planning on using to deter the Zionists?
Well, let's be realistic. Syria at this moment cannot open another front with Israel or with anybody else. We already have four occupation in Syria. We have the Turkish occupation. We have the American occupation. We have the terrorist ISIS occupation or al-Jolani in Idlib. And then we have the Kurds separatist occupation. So to open a fifth front with any other country will weaken Syria further. So what we are doing right now, and Syria is responding by attacking the military bases of the American in Syria. And we saw that happen yesterday or day before yesterday, or we saw it happening every time the Zionist entity attacks Syria. We respond against the masters.
So do you think that we might see some sort of a retaliation by Syria similar to that we saw in 2017 by downing probably one of the planes at least?
Well, anything like this, I think, will require the approval of the pact, the Iranian, the Russian, the Hezbollah. Syria will never go to war on its own decision. The same thing, I think Hezbollah also would do the same thing. There will be a consultation with all the party, the alliance, because any war and escalation on a bigger scale will require that the other party in that alliance might be involved. So in Syria, after the war started on it, does not have the sole decision-making to go to war or not to go to war. Everything now is with consultation. Any movement you see on the part of the Iranian or Hezbollah on Syria does not happen just out of a single decision. It happened because there was a consultation and the decision made by the allies, all of them, and it's been taken from there on.
So, but some people are a bit frustrated by the Russian stance and the Russian permissive and facilitating, probably. Some people are saying that the Russians are facilitating this for Israel by some analysis who were referring to the removal of the S-300s from Syria. Yet many others think that it is about time that Syria and the axis of resistance respond to the attacks against Syria, because any attack against Syria is considered an attack against the axis of resistance, in order to ensure that this act of aggression and violence will not be repeated under the pretext of avoiding being drawn into a war whose time and place would be actually here determined by the enemy instead of by the axis of resistance. But let me ask you this. What is the main reason that is preventing the entire axis of resistance from retaliating and creating some sort of a deterrence equation similar to that that's found between Lebanon and the Zionist entity? Why not create one between Syria and the Zionist entity, at least to prevent violence?
Let's be very clear. War does not be conducted with the hot head. It requires a cold reaction. You do not react immediately just because you want to take a revenge. You need to see, after the reaction and taking any action against the Zionist entity, what's the situation in Syria? Do you think the American bases in Syria would be silent? Don't you know that they would be participating in any big-scale war? The same thing on the Turkish part, the same thing on the terrorist group in Idlib. So we have more than one item to consider before we go ahead and launch similar war front like Hezbollah. The difference is between Russia and Iran. Russia said it from the beginning. They are not in Syria to protect the President Assad or to be party to any conflict between the Arab and the Zionist entity. Mm-hmm. Russia in there came to Syria with the invitation of the Syrian government solely to prevent the collapse of the government of Syria, regardless who's the president. And President Putin said it out loudly and clear. Lavrov said it also clearly in so many interviews. So everybody who blame Russia for what's happening to us is misplacing their blame, actually. As far as Iran and Hezbollah, like I said, I don't think at this stage we are ready for a full-scale war. Once the war started, anybody could start the war, but not everybody could end it the way they want. So
well,
there is more.
In less than a minute, Mr. Aqil, so do you believe that probably the targeting of U.S. occupation bases inside Syrian territory is kind of a retaliation against the aggression coming from both the U.S. and the Zionist entity, or that's a separate thing?
No, I believe it is retaliation, but I think it's a retaliation under the banner of the Syrian resistance, because the army did not claim any responsibility. The Syrian army did not claim any responsibility for that attack. So we're playing the game of we're not attacking you officially as a Syrian army, but the Syrian resistance in the area are attacking you. So everybody got the message that Syria will retaliate from now on against those bases every time it gets attacked by the Zionist entity.
Well, that brings it into a very hot plate for the Americans, who are looting hundreds of billions of dollars worth of gas and oil from Syrian fields. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Aqil Hananu, political commentator, for joining us from Georgia and for your contribution at this early time in the morning there. Thank you very much. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be discussing what's really going on in Iraq.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, the development of events in Iraq depends on the decision of the Federal Supreme Court, which is expected to be issued this week on Wednesday in the lawsuit filed by the Sadr movement before it, calling for the dissolution of the House of Representatives elected last October on the grounds that it exceeded the constitutional deadlines in electing a new president of the republic, and then assigning a government from the largest parliamentary bloc Pending the issuance of the decision, the tone of the political debate receded in Iraq, which resulted in more calm on the Iraqi streets. An anxious calm in Iraq in this following report.
It does not seem that eliciting the views of the Shia-Shia fighting in Iraq will lead to a calm at the political level, paving the way for the resumption of negotiations stalled for weeks. With the aim of finding a solution to the crisis in which the country has been floundering since last October. It was clear, though, that Muqtada Sadr, who wanted behind his recent move to give somewhat of a heads-up for his opponents, sensed that things did not go as he planned, which may explain his return, despite his announcement of his retirement from politics, to a violent and unprecedented escalation against the Iraq's coordinating framework. The so-called Minister of the Leader, also known as Saleh Muhammad al-Iraqi, who tweets on behalf of al-Sadr, lashed out for two consecutive days against the framework for not following the demands of al-Sadr and dedicated his last statement to demand the immediate change of the head of Iraq's resistance, Hashd al-Shaabi, and to remove the Hashd from the Green Zone and keep it away from border controls, sending a strongly worded message to the Secretary General of Asa'ib Ahlul Haqq, Qais al-Khaz'ali, asking him to rein in what he called impudent militias and renounce what Sadr referred to as the killers. However, choosing to absorb and ignore such statements, Qais al-Khaz'ali asked members of the movement to close all of its offices until further notice, calling on the movement's supporters not to respond to insults directed at him personally, which in turn will facilitate the extraction of conflict from the streets. This attack contrasts with al-Sadr's own praise a few days ago for the role of the Hashd al-Shaabi in ending the sedition, which despite recording some tensions in the southern governorates, does not seem to have grounds for its ignition in the form of widespread Shia-Shia fighting, which most of the political forces in Iraq are intimidated by, since none of them can bear the burden of its grave effects on the Iraqi scene. While there was no indication of a breakthrough that might re-energize the political dialogue in the next stage, the Federal Supreme Court set a date to issue a decision in the case for dissolving the House of Representatives, making it imperative for all of Iraq's political factions to wait for it, given its decisive impact on the course of developments. However, it may come. All in all, the effort that has been made during the past few days to ward off sedition is not of normal size. None of Iraq's allies remained on the sidelines, with every last one of them intervening in order to prevent the Big Bang. What was remarkable was that Iran and Hezbollah on the one hand and the Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Sistani on the other played a central role in preventing the bloodshed, in fear of possibility of something unthinkable, like a Shia-Shia civil war in an already tormented Iraq.
Now, to discuss this very pressing issue with us from Beirut is Mu'taz Al-Wahwah, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Mu'taz. Now, as long as there's no indication that a breakthrough in Iraq has been achieved in a way that relaunches maybe the political dialogue in the country, the Federal Supreme Court's setting of a date to make a decision upon the case of dissolving the House of Representatives seems to have a decisive impact on where things are going in Iraq. Everyone is actually waiting for it. What happens in the event that the decision of the court actually goes against Muqtada Sadr's aspirations?
Well, as we've seen in the past, for us to sit here and sort of draw an accurate description of what might take place when things don't go Muqtada's way, we'd be trying to sort of foretell the future here. What we've seen from Sayyid Muqtada and rather from his followers is that they're very erratic. So there's no telling exactly what would happen, whether they would take to the streets, especially now. With Sayyid Muqtada's decision to remove himself from political life, he's left this arena void of any sort of leadership here. Who will call the shots? Who will ask people to take to the streets or not take to the streets? This remains something quite ambiguous at the moment. We saw in the past, however, when things didn't go didn't go the way of the Sadri movement, when things didn't go their way. We saw chaos, we saw rioting in the streets, we saw a mini coup. We saw government institutions being taken over. There was violence on the streets. And we can only hope that this time, especially after the last bout of violence in Iraq, and Sayyid Muqtada finally calling his followers to remove themselves from the streets, we hope that there will be a calmer reaction to things. But as we said, if we were to draw an accurate picture, this is merely impossible at the moment.
But what was noticeably, maybe let's say, vigorous about the last statement issued by the so-called minister of the leader, meaning the al-Sadr as the leader here, and his minister known as Muhammad al-Iraqi, Muhammad Saleh al-Iraqi, he demanded that the head of the political body of Iraq's main resistance, al-Hashd al-Sha'bi, Mr. Faleh al-Fayyad, be changed, be removed from position because, and I quote here, he does not have a strong personality or mentality, and he is not qualified for the position. What does that have to do with anything concerning the dissolution of parliament or the formation of a new government in Iraq, or at least dialogue between political factions in Iraq?
Absolutely nothing. This is just an indication of political immaturity. When we start to mix, cards and mix issues and tie things that are unrelated to one another, especially in when we're talking about a very delicate situation like Iraq, this is only an indication of political immaturity. Mr. Sayyid Fayyad doesn't represent Parliament. He has nothing to do with Parliament, whether Parliament is dissolved or not. He's not related to the judiciary. He's not tied to any of these decisions. And at the same time, Sayyid al-Iraqi, Muqtada's minister, has nothing to do with al-Hashd al-Sha'bi and their political makeup, and it's not his call to make, really. All we can tell from this is
that the Hashd al-Sha'bi in Iraq is part of the Iraqi army according to a bill drafted by the parliament.
Correct. So the Hashd al-Sha'bi, yes, the Hashd al-Sha'bi is part of the Iraqi Defense Force, sort of semi-officially tied to the military. So this is another indication that this is not a call of Sadr's minister. It's not his place to say this, and it has nothing to do with parliament at all. This is just the only way that we can describe it is an attempt to cause a bit of chaos, maybe, and buy some time for Muqtada's party, for them to gather themselves, for the Sadr movement to gather themselves and figure out where they want to go from here on.
But that's a bit dangerous and a risky game to play, given that it was not the Hashd al-Sha'bi that was actually maybe taking to the street, Green Zone, or anywhere else. So why in specific would someone who represents al-Sadr himself, who, by the way, thanked al-Hashd al-Sha'bi for keeping peace in Iraq, why would someone like him actually call for such a statement against Hashd al-Sha'bi?
Well, again, we can see now in the Sadri movement, even before Sayyid Muqtada's last week, even before his statement last week where he claimed he was resigning from political life, there is some sort of anarchy amongst the ranks of the Sadri movement. Okay, we're not seeing a clear line of leadership. There isn't. It's not clear who exactly is calling the shots here. Those on the streets are doing one thing. Sadr's minister is saying one thing. Sayyid Muqtada himself is saying another. So it's very unclear at the moment who is actually calling the shots in this movement, if it even is the Sadri movement that is being represented in the streets. And like you said, the Hashd al-Sha'bi had no role in taking to the streets in the Green Zone, although there are some who would like to point the finger at the Hashd al-Sha'bi and say that they were there putting down the protesters and opening fire, and there was absolutely no basis for this at all. Mm-hmm. The Hashd al-Sha'bi took a clear decision to remain neutral during the last bout of violence and step aside even when their positions and their offices and bases were being attacked. Even when the homes of some of their commanders, the personal homes where their families were living, were being shot at, were being petrol bombed, and rioters were attacking their homes, the Hashd al-Sha'bi took a decision to remain neutral and not confront the protesters.
Oh, I have one in mind who would benefit from such actions, but let us stay with the Iraqi political scene here and talk about the Iraqi coordination framework, who also in itself seems to be having some inconsistencies amongst its ranks concerning dealing with the next phase in the country. There are those who are calling for proceeding with the completion of the constitutional context by forming a new government, and those who are calling for calm, for people to just sit tight and wait until we hear something coming from the court and maybe decide later on. Is that an indication that the framework bloc might disintegrate in the event the Supreme Court actually calls for re-elections?
Well, this seems to be the case for all of Iraq. Absolute ambiguity. No one really knows what is going to happen. For those who are calling to stick by current legislation or the current constitution, or if we're going to the other end, or those calling for early elections, no one really seems to have a firm grip of what's going on. And it seems to me, it's making it more and more obvious that whatever decision is going to be made, there are those in Iraq at the moment who are sitting by and are currently waiting events outside of Iraq to take place and base their decisions moving forward on that. There are some waiting on the Iran nuclear deal. There are some waiting on Saudi Arabia's relationship with Iraq, what negotiations will bring. There are some waiting on to see what the Americans are going to bring to the table. Unfortunately, this is the case in Iraq. There are many that will, at the moment, sit by and just wait for further developments in the region and then make their decisions based on that. And this is very, very tense. This is very, very dangerous when we're speaking about a volatile country like Iraq, when we have a void in government, a void in parliament. We are going to see more anarchy in the streets the longer this void continues. These gangs were going to take over the streets. These rioters who were now, as we said, unsure who was controlling them, unsure who was calling the shots, will take momentum. And the coming weeks will show. There needs to be a firm decision taken by any reasonable and logical side in Iraq. The voice of reason needs to take place, and the country's political dialogue must move forward unconditionally. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we are heading for complete anarchy.
Well, I hope that Iraqis take a chance to calm down and sit together and find a way, a peaceful way, to consider the future of their country. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mohtaz Al-Wahwah, political commentator, for joining us to talk about this very pressing matter in Iraq. And thank you. And please stay tuned next week, because we have something very, very special for you. Let's see you next week on the Middle East Stream.
Faqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned. Thank you.
همه چیز ما از امام حسین. خدا رحمت کنه مرحوم آیت الله قاصد عبدالهادی شیرازی.
Everything we have is because of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. The late Ayatollah Sayyid Abdul Hadi Shirazi, one of the greatest ulama of Najaf, used to say, "Assalamu alayka ya Abu Abdullah," at the very beginning of his salat. Once he was asked about the authenticity of this action, he replied, "The salat that we have today is because of the sacrifice that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam made to save Islam. Without al-Hussein alayhi salam, we have nothing. The blessing of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is showered on all Muslims."
پیش یکی از بزرگان مداح شروع کرد شعر خواندن.
Once a eulogist was reciting some poems about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam before some ulama. He recited, "O al-Hussein, whose soil of Karbala is my prayer stone, I won't change your soil with the whole property of Solomon." One of the ulama who was listening shed tears profusely and told the eulogist to change his poem this way: "O al-Hussein, whose soil of Karbala is my very prayer, I won't change your soil with the whole property of Solomon." The alim intended to say that the very nature of our salat is saved by Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Without Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, salat won't be saved. This also shows that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam belongs to all believers from different religions all across the world.
Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Britain's former Foreign Secretary Liz Truss has won the ruling Conservative Party's leadership race, achieving the parliamentary majority to become the country's next Prime Minister and replacing Boris Johnson, who was forced to resign after a series of scandals. Liz Truss will be coming to Downing Street facing a series of domestic and foreign challenges, such as the conflict in Ukraine and a bad economic situation recently made worse by increasing food and energy prices. Also, due to the scandals created by the former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, his wrong measures decreased the public trust in government, which will make work more difficult for the incoming Prime Minister Liz Truss. She must return to the people this lost trust. One of the actions that was taken by Boris Johnson was the Partygate scandal, which during the coronavirus pandemic meant that he was seen in forbidden parties at No. 10 Downing Street, and this greatly damaged the trust of British people in their government. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some of the world media. Please stay with us. British daily The Guardian wrote, Liz Truss was named as the new Prime Minister by first MPs at the Queen Elizabeth II Centre in Westminster on Monday, 5th of September, following a grueling 8-week leadership campaign. Truss will be coming to Downing Street facing a myriad of domestic and foreign challenges, chief among them the conflict in Ukraine and a toxic economic situation recently made worse by soaring food and energy prices. On the campaign trail, she had promised immediate action to help tackle an all-consuming cost-of-living crisis. Soaring cost of gas and electricity is widely expected to be the main issue defining her first few months in office. Her team claims it has been working on a package to help struggling households, but details of the programme have not been made public. In her victory speech on Monday, Liz Truss promised to deliver a bold plan to cut taxes and grow our economy. She said, I will deliver on the energy crisis, dealing with people's energy bills, but also dealing with the long-term issues we have on energy supply. Liz Truss ended her short maiden speech as Tory leader by promising to win the next general election in 2024. She told the audience, we need to show that we will deliver over the next 2 years. We all will deliver for our country, and I will make sure that we use all the fantastic talents of the Conservative Party. The announcement triggers the process of a handover from Boris Johnson, who stepped down in July after months of scandals saw support for his administration drain. However, according to a new YouGov opinion poll, more than half, or 52% of British voters, believe Liz Truss will be a poor or terrible Prime Minister. Liz Truss will be taking the helm as the fourth Conservative Prime Minister since a 2015 election, at a time when the country has been struggling with soaring inflation, labour strife and crisis in the public healthcare system. The leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, responded to Truss's election as the new Conservative leader by saying, after 12 years of the Tories, all we have to show for is low wages, high prices and a Tory cost-of-living crisis. Average annual household utility bills are set to increase by as much as 80% in October to £3,549, before an expected rise to £6,000 next year, decimating personal finances. China's Xinhua news agency explains more about the story. Xinhua says the UK voting took place a month after Boris Johnson was forced to step down following an avalanche of ministerial resignations over his scandal-plagued leadership. Since the winter of 2021, Britain's inflation has kept rising and successively hit new highs. Official data showed the Consumer Price Index, or the CPI, rose by 10.1% in July, far above the 2% target set by the Bank of England. The central bank projected last month that higher energy prices would push Britain's inflation to 13% in the fourth quarter of this year, and inflation is likely to remain at very elevated levels throughout much of 2023. Britain's energy regulator said in late August that the energy price cap will rise by 80% to £3,549, about $4,077 per year for an average household from October. As millions of people in Britain face the prospect of escalating bills, Keith Baker, a research fellow in fuel poverty and energy policy at Glasgow Caledonian University, said the country could face its worst peacetime crisis since the general strike of 1926. There has been a summer of disruption amid strikes by railway and airline workers, and unions across sectors are threatening waves of industrial action in the coming weeks. A dispute over the Northern Ireland Protocol, the rules governing post-Brexit trading arrangements for Northern Ireland, have strained Britain's relations with the European Union, stoking worries of a trade war if Liz Truss presses ahead with her controversial bill to rewrite the Northern Ireland Protocol. The Northern Ireland Protocol is a trade solution agreed by London and Brussels to prevent a hard border between Northern Ireland and the neighbouring Republic of Ireland following Brexit. Some experts caution these daunting challenges, if not properly tackled, could torpedo Liz Truss's premiership. News at Northeastern website elaborates more on this issue. Pablo Calderon Martinez, an assistant professor in politics and international relations at Northeastern University in London, says Liz Truss rises to prime minister at a time of crisis for the UK economy. Calderon Martinez says she has the most difficult brief of any new prime minister probably since the end of the Second World War. The former British Foreign Secretary inherits many problems from her predecessor, including high inflation, a potential recession, surging energy costs and anticipated fuel shortages for the winter ahead. Her party has been divided by scandals that consumed the three-year reign of her Tory predecessor, Boris Johnson, in whose cabinet Liz Truss served. Conservative voters selected Truss based on her campaign for lower taxes and diminished government. She beat her final round opponent, Rishi Sunak, despite his warning that taxes shouldn't be cut until Britain curbs its bout of double-digit inflation. Another major difference separating the two candidates was Liz Truss's perceived loyalty to Boris Johnson, whose demise was instigated in July by Rishi Sunak's resignation as Chancellor of the Exchequer. It's about trusting government, the division that has emerged in the Conservative Party between Johnson loyalists and the people that wanted to get him out of office since the very beginning, is pretty much similar to what we've seen in the United States for the Republican Party around Donald Trump. It's almost a battle for the soul of the Conservative Party. Balancing these different groups is going to be very challenging for Liz Truss.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question. That question is about the talqeen. What is the talqeen? A lot of our listeners might be non-Muslims. They might not be acquainted with what this term means. But just to explain it for them, the talqeen is a ritual that is performed for the dead person, the corpse, the dead body of the Muslim who dies. When they put the Muslim in the grave, the person in the grave, before they cover his body and they close the grave with the dirt, they do the talqeen, meaning they kind of tilt the body and shake the body, and they kind of remind this dead person of his Islamic beliefs. They say, your God is one God, your book is the Quran, your prophet is the Prophet Muhammad, and so on and so forth. So the question that we kind of want to ask today is regarding this ritual. What is this ritual? Why is it important? What is the meaning behind it? Why do we do it? And does it really, first of all, does it really have any benefit for somebody, who didn't really believe in these kind of things in the first place? Didn't really have, a firm belief in these verities. So the way we answer this question is this, the first part of the question, is that the death is a very momentous occasion for a human being. It's a time when, he's going through a very perilous state. It's a very fearful time. It's possible that at this time, this person might, forget certain religious verities, certain religious truths, right? So because of that, we have been asked to perform this talqeen to kind of remind the person, of these truths and these beliefs. And also, another reason it could be this, that, after the person goes in the grave, we have narrations that angels come and they ask him his religious beliefs, right? So possibly the talqeen is kind of a reminder to remind the person, kind of like a refresher of his beliefs, that, prepare him for this examination that these angels are going to be taking from him, right? But in connection with this, and to answer the second part of the question, we could say that this would only be beneficial, right, for a person who has these beliefs in the first place, right? If somebody doesn't believe in these in the first place, right, and doesn't really have any firm, belief in his heart of these truths, right, it's not going to really have any benefit for him, right? So, we have a narration regarding a person. One day, Imam Ridha alayhi salam, was sitting with his companions, and he turns to his companions and said, such and such a person died, and he's in the grave right now. And when the angels came and asked him, about his beliefs, when they got to the question regarding me, the person was unable to ask because he didn't believe in me in his life, right? So, this talqeen, it only has a benefit for, these people who had these, beliefs to a certain extent in their life. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the benefit of the talqeen. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.